And Dr. Nancy Anderson is going to tell us a little bit about the legal design and about how we can achieve this for our society. Dr. Anderson has her BA and PhD from NYU. She's a lifelong New Yorker. She wrote the Community Right to Know Law, co-authored recycling laws, and helped prevent the sale of the city's water supply. She has long experience in working in government in New York City, and now she's the executive director of the Salon Foundation, which is work to advance useful knowledge for the greening of cities. Dr. Nancy Anderson.
Good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here this evening, although I found myself wondering after listening to Dina's very informative presentation if we wouldn't all be healthier and safer outside. Back in Renaissance Italy, there was a type of painting, and it was called paintings of ideal cities, or the città ideale. And in these ideal cities, you would see blue sky, no litter on the streets, no polluting smoke coming up from the smokestacks, certainly no traffic jams, but you also saw no people. They were just white, stainless marble vistas. So that's one kind of ideal city. Fast forward to the city we all live in right now, New York City. Maybe the Big Apple, it may be the capital of the 20th or 21st century, but it has its problems. New York City often likes to think of itself as an especially sustainable city. We all take subways to school or to work, or buses, or walk, or bike. We live and work in big, dense buildings that are very energy efficient. We don't have to travel in from the suburbs to see a friend for dinner or buy a bottle of milk. But I want to argue that New York cannot rest on its laurels. New York City is a sustainable city by dint of history. New York is sustainable in a sense as a historical accident. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, we built our mass transit system. In the late 19th century, the technology for building skyscrapers, the elevator and the steel frame building were invented, and New York, as well as cities like Chicago, became those vertical towers of steel and granite that we all live and work in now. The extraordinary Con Ed system of electrification. If you go down into Lower Manhattan, you'll see the first electric power generating plant in the country that Thomas Edison built, and it was first built, I believe it illuminated something like 400 light bulbs. It's gotten bigger, it's grown. Con Ed not only provides electricity, but in parts of Manhattan south of 96th Street, this is an early 20th century technology. Buildings are heated with Con Ed steam. One of the buildings I used to work in, the municipal building, is heated with Con Ed steam. So is the American Museum of Natural History. These are all good things, but we've got a century of this under our belt. And today, in 2007, we know, as Jenny pointed out, that 79% of New York City's carbon dioxide emissions comes from our built environment, comes from lighting buildings, heating buildings, cooling buildings, running our computers, plugging in our cell phones, et cetera, et cetera. It was an extraordinary finding, an extraordinary number. The United Nations Environmental Program, just 2 weeks before, had issued a report at a global level saying, well, the built environment is a major source of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. And something that the Kyoto Protocol had really overlooked. and had really done very little to regulate. And the figure that UNEP used was 30 to 40%. So this tells us in New York we have our work cut out for us. And I'd like to suggest that the work that's cut out for us and the solution to our problems by using law and politics and legislation is as easy as 1, 2, 3. Or at least 1, 2, 3, looking at it as Max Weber, a famous German sociologist, would call ideal types. So what I'm going to be talking about for the rest of the evening is the 1, 2, 3, which oversimplifies the way the real world works. But in simplifying it, I hope to be able to cast some light on where we are, how we got there, and how to move on. In considering the built environment, and the particular part of the built environment that I spend a great deal of my time thinking about, buildings, homes, schools, office buildings, infrastructure. We are at the beginning of a new era. We are at the beginning of an era of sustainable, or sometimes called green, or sometimes called high performance buildings. And I would argue that the one of the 1, 2, 3, the first generation of high performance buildings, we can take our hats off to and thank an extraordinary generation of visionaries and explorers. For the visionaries and explorers back in ancient times, maybe 1995, 1996, the law was not the friend of the visionary or the explorer. In the New York City context, the laws that mattered are the building codes, the zoning rules, and the tax code. Despite an inhospitable legislative climate, there were people who got it. There were people who early on understood that buildings could be built with better indoor air quality for workers, for residents, for occupants. Buildings could be built considering the supply chain issues that Dina was talking about, to consider the total impact on the environment of the buildings we choose to build, the buildings we choose to live and work in. So we saw this first generation of visionaries, and I would invite, I guess it'll be kind of dark when we get out of here this evening, but for those of you who are members of the Cooper Union community, I would invite you when you're back later in the week to take a walk in the East Village and to take a look at some extraordinary visionary buildings that are hiding in plain sight in the East Village. On 299, 227, 228 East 3rd Street, at 242 East 2nd Street, series of buildings that have all gone up within the last 10 years, if not even more recently, that are low income, affordable, extraordinarily energy efficient houses. Buildings that use 85% less electricity, less fuel to heat them, to light them, to keep families comfortable. You wouldn't know that these buildings were visionaries and explorers from just walking by. They look pretty ordinary on the outside, but if you know what's going on in the inside, and many of you here, I'm sure, are engineering students and design students and architects, all of these buildings should have plaques on them saying, these are the visionaries, these are the explorers. These buildings put facts on the ground. They show it can be done. They show it can be done within scales and economies that make them practical. They can inspire and do inspire other people to do it too. As Kenneth Boulding said somewhere, What exists is possible. Step number two, and it's easy as 1, 2, 3. Our visionaries and explorers and the facts on the ground have helped to create a universe, a population of stakeholders, people who want to build the next generation of high-performance buildings, environmental advocates, housing advocates, policy wonks in government, all of whom say, oh, there really is a better way. It really can be done. And in looking at the law and looking at legislation at step two, we see that the laws law move slowly, but we begin to see the appearance of various pilot programs and funds to support one building here, another building there, one in Brooklyn, one in the Bronx, a couple in Manhattan. More facts on the ground begin to be created. In New York State in 2001, the legislature passed a green building tax credit law, and it made $25 million in tax credits available for developers who are putting up new, brand new buildings that would be energy efficient, would be resource smart, and eight buildings, right, developments, in fact, were the beneficiaries of those, that $25 million. If you go up something that's not hiding in plain sight, something that's a real eye-popper, you go up to 8th Avenue and 57th Street and the new Hearst Tower, which is certainly an extraordinary building on the outside, an extraordinary building on the inside, too. It collects and harvests rainwater, and it uses that water to as part of its cooling system. It uses that water for an indoor waterfall that's an extraordinary amenity. There's an old building, or an old ruin, actually, out on Roosevelt Island. It's called the Octagon, and it is being converted into affordable housing courtesy of the same tax benefit money. But it's $25 million, which sounds like a lot, but you know what? In New York real estate, it runs out pretty quickly. New York State is also the beneficiaries, New Yorkers are the beneficiaries of energy power research and pilot programs run by a state agency called NYSERDA. It's funded by everyone in this room who pays an electric bill in New York. If you read all the fine print and you get to the bottom line, you pay a little extra system benefit charge every month that goes to very, very good purposes to help New Yorkers learn how to be energy efficient, to help New Yorkers learn how to build and live in more sustainable buildings and more sustainable cities. We start getting more advocates out there saying, oh, this stuff, this works. This works. What can we do in the public sector? What can we do in the public sphere? What can we do with our legislation to expand the pilot programs, to move from where I think we are now, having a set of wonderful, green, sustainable poster child buildings? And what we need to do, and what I believe we need legislation for, is to move from the generation of the poster child to the generation of the new normal, as in, of course, that's how you build a building or renovate a building. How else would one ever consider it? Before moving quite to legislation, I did want to point out one other soon-to-be-built poster-child building of really advanced sustainable design, because it's a Cooper Union building. I guess it's a hole in the ground now, but soon to be constructed, the new engineering building just across just across the street on the corner of 7th and 3rd, is going to be an extremely sophisticated, high-performance building that will make extensive use of daylighting throughout the building. That will be, as I understand, a building that has a double skin. And in the summer, it'll keep the heat out. And in the wintertime, this double skin will act like a winter coat and keep the cold out and keep the heat and the warmth in and make a much, much more energy efficient building. And it's a visionary structure. As each new poster child is built, we get more of these facts on the ground that I was talking about. We're able to assess their costs. We're able to assess how they work. And as Lord Kelvin said, to measure is to know. And that brings us to a moment in New York City government where we have New York's first green building law called Local Law 86. And it requires all government buildings, all public buildings, and all buildings that get more than $2 million in public funds to be built really green and really sustainable. The thing about passing legislation is it's like getting married. It's just the beginning, folks. Because, and I think this is something I'm saying from 20 years experience in city government, to pass a law, pass a good law, is a great accomplishment. But then we need to be vigilant to get its regulations passed, to get it implemented, to get it funded, to get it enforced, and to make sure that the laws that will help make a sustainable city are living letters and not dead letters of the law. We are moving towards that point, and now with the mayor's announcement of his long-term plan for New York, his 2030 plan, we have a new launching platform, a new policy platform, a new legal platform, or hope to be legal platform. We have a mobilized public, and that is all of you, to help make sure that we know what we are doing, we design smart, we build smart, we advocate for the kinds of laws, the kind of tax policies, and the kind of citizenry that will fill up those green buildings and create a granite garden in New York. Thank you.